We have to be expanding our nuclear capacity. Finally, we have a bipartisan approach to nuclear on Capitol Hill.
Unprecedented demand from electrification, data centers, and AI.
It's speed of deployment. Big tech wants it yesterday. Behind the meter generation using auto cycle engines. Really a remarkable development.
And the build out of nuclear as a potential fix for this demand spike.
Alternative energy sources that are weather dependent. We don't need that. We need reliable, baseload, always on, carbon-free power. And nuclear is the only thing that can provide that.
Hey, everybody, and welcome to Power Perspectives. I'm Kinsey Grant Baker. Don't call it a nuclear comeback, at least not quite yet. Now, I get the temptation with all of that, though. I mean, over the last year or so, the Trump administration has launched what it's calling a nuclear renaissance, complete with executive orders and multi-billion dollar investments to accelerate advanced reactor deployment and establish fueling pilot programs and build out a nuclear supply chain and so much more. The US and the UK announced a new nuclear partnership. The Three Mile Island nuclear power plant is set to restart in a few years thanks to Microsoft. And in the last handful of years, dozens of countries have pledged to triple nuclear capacity by 2050. It seems like the word nuclear is the only one both left and right can agree on these days. But have we gotten ahead of our skis here? Are we being realistic about messy timelines, financing gaps, permitting headaches, and fundamental grid questions? How do we, honestly, think about what a nuclear renaissance means in practice as well as in theory? That's what we are up to today, separating the news from the noise to determine the real future and real promise of nuclear power. I'm thrilled to welcome a celebrated author, speaker, film producer who has been writing about energy, power, politics, and innovation for more than three decades. You might know him from his incredibly popular Substack. Welcome to Power Perspectives, Robert Bryce. How are you today?
Well, fantastic, Kinsey. It's a long list of things we have to get through. Is this podcast 2 or 3 days long? How many?
we're gonna do our best here. We're gonna do our best to take a quick tour of nuclear. And as you mentioned, this is a topic that is very, very rich that we could go very, very deep on, which is why I recommend people check out your Substack where you are doing that on a regular basis. We'll definitely throw the link in the description for this episode because it's some really great content. So we're excited to have you here today.
Thank you. And in the list, you forgot the restart at Palisades. So just another example of, I think, what is clearly, as you point out, the nuclear comeback or resurgence in interest in nuclear. And I think you made an important point there, Kinsey, about now finally, we have a bipartisan approach to nuclear on Capitol Hill, which is something that is new. And a long time ago, a guy who worked at the DOE told me something that stuck in my head. And until recently, I think it was true. It was that Republicans are pro-nuclear and anti-government. Democrats are pro-government and anti-nuclear. And now, if you're going to be pro-nuclear, you have to be pro-government. It's something we should talk about because this is one of the key issues, I think, for the U.S. as we look at this entire sector. We are getting more bipartisan support for nuclear power, and arguably under the Trump administration, some of the biggest and most important support by a sitting U.S. president since Eisenhower. So I'm very encouraged. I'm also very sober.
Yes, absolutely. And I think this is a great way to start the conversation here, Robert. Encouraged, but sober. I know that you have written in your newsletter before. I'm going to quote you to you, which I'm sure you love when that happens. But you wrote recently, "I'm adamantly pro-nuclear. I've been saying the same thing for more than 15 years. If we're serious about decarbonization, we should be pursuing end-to-end natural gas to nuclear." But with that in mind, you have also written a lot about the sober parts of the reality of nuclear, which is really what I want to talk about today. But before we get into that, if you don't mind, can you kind of set the record straight? You know, we got the bit of the primer there at the top here about your perspective on nuclear, but in a sentence or two, can you kind of tell me how you're thinking about this position of being adamantly pro-nuclear, but also, you know, realistic about what it'll take to get there?
That's a good question. And I think first, let me start by just addressing the energy security issue of why I'm pro-nuclear. And that is we have more coal than any other country in the world, but I'm not betting on the U.S. building more coal plants. If we're serious about energy security broadly, and I mean by that the stability, the reliability, the affordability of power, electric power in the U.S., we have to be expanding our nuclear capacity because we can't expand our coal capacity. We can't expand hydro. The grid is becoming too dependent on a single fuel. I'm absolutely in favor of natural gas, but what we are facing is a grid that is becoming too dependent on a single just-in-time fuel, and that is natural gas. So I'm absolutely, 100% behind the expansion of nuclear energy for a lot of reasons, for footprints. I'm an adamant and longtime critic of the wind business because of its footprint, because of its impact on wildlife, particularly birds and bats. And the only way that wind and solar can expand dramatically is with more land. And this is one of the great things about nuclear power, is the small footprint. Okay, so this is the why I'm so pro-nuclear. But in terms of the sober part of it, I've got no dog in the fight. I don't own any nuclear stocks. I don't work. I'm an independent journalist. But we have to be very clear about the what is the obvious fact, which is that the nuclear industry in the U.S. didn't decline over a year or two. It declined over decades. Bringing it back will take a similar kind of timeline, and it's going to require very staunch and committed and bipartisan decadal support from the federal government. And given the, you know, the nastiness in Washington, which is, you know, been ongoing for years, this is going to be the big challenge. But also we have the supply chain, we have the fuel issues, we have the workforce issues, all of which are going to be the other parts of this. And then I haven't mentioned the NRC and the permitting, et cetera, but all of these together have to be considered together. And so that's why I'm sober.
Yeah. And a great point to start us off here, this idea that it took decades to unwind, it's going to take decades to rewind the clock here to get us back to a position where everybody can feel, you know, excited about nuclear, yes, but also that it can change the grid at scale. I think that's really the difference here. There is all of that excitement. There is a ton of optimism. We have talked about it on this show many, many times. But what we're going to do today is kind of parse through some of those challenges and how we get to that point over the next, you know, several decades to come. So let's start. I want to start this part of the conversation with a bit of a, you know, perspective here on the demand element of all of this. You know, the reason we're talking about nuclear potentially swooping in and saving the day here is because we're staring down a pretty significant spike in demand. That's why, you know, new generation is such an important part of the conversation here. So in your perspective, how should we be interpreting these headlines about this spike in demand, about this, you know, unprecedented demand from electrification and reshoring and data centers and AI? Tell me a little bit about sort of your high level thoughts on this idea of load really significantly increasing. And that's why we're sort of having this conversation about nuclear and other generation sources.
Kinsey, the word that you use there, I think is the key, is the scale of the challenge. Okay, so today in the U.S., we're getting, 18-19% of our electricity from nuclear energy. We have 95, 98 installed nuclear reactors. Then let's look at the scale of the demand that is coming just from AI. So EPRI, Electric Power Research Institute, last year estimated 50 gigawatts of new demand from AI by 2030. I've talked to a lot of people in the nuclear sector, and I'm always talking to them. And I say, okay, blue sky it for me. Assume everything goes great. How many gigawatts of new nuclear capacity will the U.S. add over the next 10 years or by 2035? The broad consensus is that we will be lucky, if everything goes right, to have 10,000 megawatts of new nuclear capacity online within the next 10 years. Well, EPRI's saying we're going to add 50 gigawatts of AI demand in the next five. And so it's very clear to me that the AI boom that is happening now and the AI thirst for power, almost all of that is going to be met with gas-fired turbines. I mean, that's clear. We have more than 20 gigawatts of gas-fired capacity in the hopper under construction now. So nuclear is, you know, we're getting the engine going, but to get that flywheel of supply chain, of proper fuel, HALEU, TRISO, you know, low enriched uranium, all of the things that are going to have to happen on that side, and the permitting, that flywheel is going to take a long time to get going. So again, we have to think about this in decadal timeframes instead of, oh, we're going to have this online and Meta's going to be, or, you know, whoever, Google's going to be using nuclear power at their new AI data center. No, that's just not going to happen.
Yeah. And this is why you say AI is a gas story, right?
Well, it's the only form of generation that can be deployed relatively quickly. Now, the key there is relatively. And the supply chain is in place. And the tech companies have effectively infinite amounts of money to deploy. And now you have, I mean, look at what has happened in the power sector just in the last couple of years. You have Williams, a Tulsa-based company. I'm proud from a proud Oklahoman, native roots in Oklahoma for on both sides of my family, going back to before statehood. You have Williams going into the power sector now with multiple gigawatts of capacity coming online. Chevron, the multinational integrated oil company, is going to be building at least two gigawatts of gas-fired capacity in the Permian Basin. So when you see who's coming into the game, it's not just the old utility guys. It's not just Vistra or Constellation or whoever, or Duke, or, you know, the opportunity here to build and deploy gas-fired generation is attracting massive amounts of capital from non-utility players.
And I think it's a helpful tool for us in this conversation as well to sort of counter nuclear and the build out of nuclear as a potential fix for this demand spike against gas, against some of these, you know, more traditional parts of the system that we know can get online pretty quickly, that we do see have these, you know, huge investments and huge names and players behind them as well. So let's run through some of those challenges.
And if I can just add one quick point on my Substack, robertbrice.substack.com. I wrote about the Otto cycle engine. This is just a couple of days ago, pointing out that Williams or some of the big Vistra or some of these companies that are going to build capacity for AI and data centers, they're using gas-fired turbines from GE Vernova, Mitsubishi, and Siemens, right? And those three companies have effectively a monopoly on new turbines. But the lag time for new turbines is 3 to 4 or more years. So what have we seen, again, back to the speed of deployment story, is that companies are entering into the behind-the-meter generation race by using big auto cycle engines, so four-stroke spark-ignited engines, a 150-year-old technology. So who's doing it? Wärtsilä, the Finnish company, has since last July announced 1.2 gigawatts of new capacity behind the meter for data centers. Bergen Engines, a subsidiary of Langley Holdings, was at the PowerGen conference in San Antonio last month. This was the big theme at PowerGen, behind-the-meter generation using auto cycle engines. So again, you know, it's speed of deployment. The big tech wants it yesterday, right? Google, Meta, Amazon, they want this deployed as yesterday, and they have effectively infinite amounts of money. So not only is it going to be gas, it's not just going to be gas turbines, it's going to be reciprocating engines, which is really a remarkable development. Liberty Energy is another one. Caterpillar is another one. This is Jenbacher, another privately held company with Jenbacher engines made in Austria. So, I mean, the name of the game is speed, and that is not speed is not the name of the game, unfortunately, in the nuclear sector.
Yeah, it's really interesting, Robert, to counter this idea of, you know, supply chain speed to deployment, speed to power is really all that matters to these big tech companies. We talk so much about the supply chain issues, the holdups, the wait times when we're talking about gas turbines, and to think that that's actually the quick option when compared to nuclear is pretty interesting to really, you know, let sink in. So let's talk about that supply chain for nuclear and some of the challenges that might, you know, persist throughout that supply chain. Obviously, sure, it's complicated, lots of different elements to sort of parse through there. But I'm curious that, you know, the kind of top level here, what are some of the biggest supply chain challenges when we're looking at speed to power for nuclear?
I think one of the key ones, Kinsey, is we're talking about supply chain. I would say labor before even parts. As a friend of mine who works at a large EPC firm told me, if we had the parts, we don't have the people. If we have the people, we don't have the parts. And another company at PowerGen, one of their representatives who's been in the power generation sector his whole career, told me, I've spent the last 30 years begging for work. He said, now people are coming to me. He'd been at a hotel bar across the street from the convention center in San Antonio all day. And he said, executives are just coming to him. And he said, in January alone, he personally turned down 4 multi-billion dollar generation projects because he doesn't have the people to do it. So this is indicative of the kind of, I'm going to use the word land rush or a description of land rush mentality, but that's what we're seeing, is this incredible fervor, this, you know, about everybody wanting to build it all at once. So supply chain is different from the labor issue, but this is one that I hear over and over and over again from people in the power sector, is who do they need? They need more electricians. They need more welders. They need more electric linemen, journeyman linemen. They need people who are willing to get dirty, have their names on their shirts, and will show up and can pass a drug test. So Now, to the supply chain, this is, you know, how, you know, where do you want to start? Is it the long lead times for high power transformers, for distribution transformers, for switchgear, all of those elements of new build generation? And then I think the other key pinch point here is going to be the fuel part of it, whether it's HALEU, TRISO, low-enriched uranium. We get still about 20% of our nuclear fuel from the Russians. The Russians are not our friends. We have to shut off that according to the bill that was passed, signed into law, I think, in 2024 by President Biden, authored by John Barrasso from Wyoming, will prohibit the importation of Russian fuel by 2027. So, yeah, I mean, which part of the supply chain you want to talk about?
Let's do the fuel thing. I think this is really interesting, especially in light of how many headlines we've seen recently about trying to shore up a more domestic supply chain for nuclear fuel. You know, these critical minerals is something, a pair of words that I have said more times in the last year than I ever thought I would. This is a really important part of the conversation. So when we see, you know, headlines from the Trump administration making moves to try to shore up that domestic supply chain for nuclear, does it move the needle? Can you tell me a little bit more about, you know, what some of this news might mean? Has there been any progress in terms of securing that fuel element of the supply chain for nuclear? Where are we right now?
Sure. I'm waiting for the EIA to release their new numbers on uranium oxide supply, but I'll read you from, this is from the EIA from January 30th of 2025. Their quote directly from their analysis was, imports accounted for 99% of the uranium oxide used in 2023 to make nuclear fuel. And I've used their data to create a graphic showing that, you know, back into the 1970s and early 1980s, the U.S. was essentially self-sufficient when it came to uranium oxide. But we were mining uranium then, and now we're effectively not mining uranium at all in the United States. And so we have outsourced this. And the uranium, remember, is only one part of the discussion, because it's one of, and I know this critical minerals is the way that people talk about them. I think that's actually my preferred label for that, and I think it's the more correct one, is strategic elements. Because they're not necessarily minerals, they're elements, and uranium is one of them. But you also look at the other parts of the rare earth elements that are needed in the nuclear sector as well. And who controls those? China. So the supply chain goes, yes, it's about fabrication of the reactor itself. It's about the supply chain for the transformers. But it also is, I'm going to use a pun here, elemental. It is elemental by the periodic table of the elements, which I'm sure my high school chemistry teacher, Miss Plackey, would be laughing her ass off if she would know I was telling anyone to pay attention to the periodic table because I was a bad chemistry student. But nevertheless, the chemistry here matters. And China and Russia are the ones that have effectively the U.S. and every other country in the world by the short and curlies when it comes to these strategic elements. And that is, again, the other part of this story that won't be solved quickly, cheaply, or easily.
Yeah. And I'm curious how it factors into energy security. You know, we started this conversation talking about energy security, about the need for nuclear to determine the future of energy security in the United States. If we are so reliant on countries like China and Russia for the nuclear supply chain, does that pose a threat to the possibility that nuclear could improve our energy security here?
Well, I think that that's a good point. Over the long term, I don't think that there's any doubt that nuclear can and should improve our energy security. But to get there, we have to overcome these challenges of supply chain. So I'm just pulled up the periodic table. So memory serves. So samarium, gadolinium, dysprosium, all are part of the lanthanides, that, you know, line on the periodic table beyond, below the main U shapes. Those are used in the nuclear sector. And China, back to the timing here, since the days of Deng Xiaoping in the early 1990s, when Deng went on a tour called the Southern Tour and said, the Mideast has oil, China has rare earths, we're going to exploit rare earths. So China, for the last 30 years, has been creating this monopoly effect, global monopoly on rare earth elements. And it's been completely backed and fundamentally backed by the Chinese government. So to come back to what we discussed earlier, Kinsey, this is the area where the U.S. government and the U.S. as a whole does not have a choice when it comes to the issues of supply chain around nuclear and particularly nuclear fuel. The U.S. government has to be involved and directly involved in these issues, in these supply chains. And we've seen that with the government getting into deals with Centrus, with BWXT, in rare earths with MP Materials. There's been some criticism of this. Oh, this is mercantilism. Well, yeah, it is. Yeah, it is. And the only way you're going to counter China's mercantilism is with our own brand of mercantilism.
Yeah. You know, it's a really interesting way to put it, Robert. And I think it's a good segue to talk about the role of the government in general. We started this conversation, you mentioned that being pro-nuclear these days means being pro-government as well. Tell me a little bit about the role of the government in this shift in perspective around nuclear for the general energy consensus and just sort of everyday people outside of our industry as well. We have seen the sort of public skepticism wane. I'm curious about the role of the government in making that happen. Is my first question. My follow-up will be, we can get to it, but I'm curious if you think the government is doing enough. You know, tell me a little bit about where you stand in terms of the government's role in all of this.
I have plenty of criticisms of the Trump administration and President Trump in specific. I think in some of the things he's done, I'm totally aghast at how he has approached a lot of issues, and not least of which is Rob Reiner's death. I mean, I could go on, right, in terms of the things where I think he's just lost the thread and is misrepresenting and badly representing the United States. But when it comes to the energy front, I think pretty much everything that Trump and his team have been doing is absolutely on the dot. I mean, really well done. I don't know of one issue where I look at what they're doing and think they're wrong there. On the nuclear front in particular, the four executive orders that President Trump signed last summer, I believe, those are the most important endorsements of nuclear energy by a sitting U.S. president since Eisenhower's Atoms for Peace speech in 1953. This administration has done more to advance the cause of nuclear energy than any administration in American history. So I will give them all due credit and enthusiastically supportive of what they're trying to do. And, you know, there are a number of other issues, the fast tracking of the 10 different companies by next July 4th. The acceleration of permitting, changing the face or, you know, what's happening at the NRC, pushing the DOD to their Department of War now to accelerate the deployment and development and deployment of their own nuclear reactors. So all of these together really are unprecedented and well thought out and really much needed. The challenge, Kinsey, will be after the midterms, because Trump has not helped the Republicans at all with his tariffs, with his, you know, his push on immigration. If they lose in the midterms, whether the Democrats are going to start pushing back on some of these things, because it's likely, from what I, you know, the analysis that I've heard, that the Senate will likely be taken over by the Democrats. But that's only in 2020, you know, the next 2 years. What happens in 2028? You know, if God forbid President Newsom or, you know, not just picking on him, but we have a change in the White House in political party, then what? And will this staunch support for nuclear continue? We can't have a 4-year back and forth where it's gone again, off again. We need a 40-year outlook instead of a 4-year outlook when it comes to nuclear in Washington.
Yeah. And I imagine this is one of the biggest challenges to anybody who's trying to innovate anything new in the energy space, is that we do have this political whiplash when we're looking at projects that take decades, if not longer, to come to fruition. A 4-year administration is really, really tough to contend with.
I'll quickly add, and you have an entrenched group of very well-funded NGOs, the Sierra Club, the Natural Resource Defense Council, Riverkeeper, Environmental Defense Fund, who are running on budgets of hundreds of millions of dollars per year, and they're all uniformly anti-nuclear. So, and they are the ones who have, particularly in the Biden administration, you know, had entrenched people inside the administration to gum up the works for nuclear and, you know, promote alt energy and the rest of it. So it's not just the political class, it's this entrenched anti-industry that is, I believe, anti-energy, anti-nuclear, and they're very powerful, and they're not going away just because Trump is in power. Now, they're not as powerful as they were, but they're not, it's not like they're gone. They're going to continue to exert influence, and though any win in their view for nuclear is a loss for solar and wind, and they're, you know, religious about, you know, is this supporting these alternative energy sources that are weather dependent. We don't need that. We need reliable baseload, always on carbon-free power, and nuclear is the only thing that can provide that.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm curious how that reality, that it's not just what's happening on Capitol Hill, it's also what's happening at these NGOs across the country, has a real impact on the energy industry and on the winners and losers. How do, let's say, you know, these small modular reactor, these SMR startups that have gotten a ton of funding, excitement, headlines lately, how might they factor that reality into the way that they plan for innovation or for their attempts to grow their businesses, to build SMRs at scale? Tell me a little bit more about what that, you know, that approach might look like for some of these companies that are trying to, you know, deal with a lot of external factors, but also try to make the most of a moment of what feels to be pretty palpable excitement.
I don't think they need any more excitement. I would argue, Kinsey, that there is excessive excitement about SMRs. And I say that, again, just trying to be very sober about it. You know, look at some of the valuations for these companies that have gone public, and I'll just name one, NuScale. I wrote about NuScale 18 years ago. That company still has not built a nuclear reactor, and I don't know what their market capitalization today is. It's, you know, several billion dollars. And why can't they get any traction in the marketplace? Why, despite all these years of hype, despite being a multi-billion dollar market cap company, they still haven't built a reactor? But it's not just NuScale, and I'm picking on them. Look at Oklo, look at Nano Nuclear, look at Terrestrial Energy. These are companies that have all gone public at, I think, I will say, absurd valuations. And yet they haven't produced a single watt hour of anything, right? So the sizzle here is far exceeding the, you know, the, what is it? Sell the sizzle, not the steak, or whatever it is. But the other part that I think is essential to understand, and I've worked with my son Jacob on this, we've created a two compendia of the SMR competitors, and we published it on my Substack, robertbryce.substack.com. And in the U.S. alone, there are 40 SMR companies with 46 reactor designs. Globally, there are another, in 19 countries, there are 55 entities with 72 reactors. So all in, you have globally, when you look at the SMR sector, I'm not going to call it an industry because it's not really an industry yet. It's a sector of the energy environment or energy business. There are 95 entities with 118 reactor designs. We have three companies that make gas turbines. And yet now we have, and they have, you know, different sizes of turbines, of course, but there are three. And we have now 95 entities in the U.S. We have 40 alone. We need three or four. And so this is the big, there is a shakeout that is coming in the SMR sector. And it's going, a lot of capital is going to be destroyed as this winnowing out of the SMR designs, SMR companies. A lot of companies are going to fall by the wayside. A lot of money is going to be lost. And it remains to be seen which companies will emerge. Although I can, you know, give you my ideas about who might be the winners.
I would love to hear those ideas.
Well, okay, so let's just look at start from the existing reactor base and think about the regulatory pathways and the supply chains. So what do we have in the U.S.? We have all effectively light water reactors running on low-enriched uranium. So I have nothing against salt-cooled reactors, gas-cooled reactors, other designs that are, you know, these SMR companies are proposing. But if I'm looking at the easiest way to get licensing and get traction and have the supply chain be available and have operators that know the technology and the regulators know the technology, I'd be developing a light water reactor that's smaller, that looks like the big reactors. And further, I'd be looking at the companies that are already in the business, that are well capitalized, that have manufacturing capacity today. So I'm not, like I said, I haven't put any money into this. I don't own any uranium companies. I don't own any of the, you know, the equities in these companies, but I think GE Vernova is in a very good position because they have a technology, the BWRX 300, that is a light water reactor. They're building one of those in Ontario. They've started construction. They're well capitalized. I think their market cap's $300 billion. BWXT, which is used to be Babcock and Wilcox, which built the boilers that Edison used on Pearl Street. They are supplying reactors to the military and have been for decades, and they're developing a gas-cooled reactor. So those are two names that I think are really interesting, as well as Holtec, which is a company that's been around for a long time. They're going to go public later this year. I think the momentum and in the manufacturing and the established market caps and of these companies is going to be incredibly important, because all of these SMR companies, if, you know, let's just say Oklo or, you know, I don't know, TerraPower, Bill Gates's company, they suddenly get traction. They're going to need massive amounts of capital to scale up. You know, Bill Gates can afford it, right? But, you know, can some of these other companies, you know, pick one, you know, Flybe, Radiant, I don't know, you know, Last Energy, you know, Antares, you know, can they raise the billions that they're going to need? Yeah, I don't know. We'll see.
Yeah. And especially after that wheat sort of gets separated from the chaff, it'll be interesting to see how much more capital is deployed in this space, right? The public interest might wane at the same time as the interest from the venture funds that are spending all of this money.
Or at the time that, you know, after the AI boom ends, and it's going to end, well, is there going to be that much new latent demand that is going to justify the deployment of billions, tens of billions of capital for a new nuclear reactor design? And then we haven't talked about, and I should briefly mention, are SMRs even the way to go, or should we be building gigawatt scale reactors? And yeah, my friend Emmett Penny, who I, you know, admire quite a bit, he's written about this, and he wrote a very good report. And he co-authored a very good report a few weeks ago, talking about this very, very issue. His report comes out on the gigawatt reactor scale, right? That we should be building, if we have all this new demand and we have a design, the AP1000, that's already been built, why won't we go, why not go with that? You know, instead of taking this other regulatory risk with all of these other companies that are in, that are startups, rank startups, many of them.
Yeah. I mean, that was my next question, was what do you think moves the needle more? Is it reopening, recommissioning some of these big plants, like we mentioned at the beginning, like, you know, the Three Mile Islands of the world? Is it trying to build out a more sophisticated, more advanced SMR sector into an industry? It's interesting to think about what the, you know, the version of the future for nuclear is that moves the needle the most, that gets us to that place where we're a couple decades down the road and nuclear is something that's not just a fun idea that we can kind of all agree on finally. So when we're looking at these plants reopening, what do you think is the most significant part of that story that we should pay the most attention to? Is it further reopenings down the line? Is it the big tech companies that are sort of bankrolling some of these deals with really long-term PPAs? What's your perspective?
It's simple. It's that these plants are already there. The concrete has been poured. They, you know, the communities like them, and they don't need any new, I mean, they need new permits from the NRC, but it's not some radical new something or other, right? This is all familiar, right? So in short, it's far easier to restart the old than to build the new. Remember, I mean, we only have, what, Three Mile Island and Palisades. Oh, well, and then Duane Arnold in Nebraska, right? What is that, 2.5 gigawatts? You know, at most, I think Palisades is 800. I forgot Three Mile Island. Duane Arnold's not that big, you know, 600 megawatts. So, you know, call it 2 gigawatts. Doesn't move the needle. I mean, does not move the needle, Kinsey, in terms of when compared to 2 gigawatts of revived nuclear, not new, not, I'm not going to say it's new nuclear, it's revived, resuscitated, Heimlich maneuver nuclear, versus a total new build, new design, new size, new chemistry, new regulatory regime, you know, et cetera. So, I mean, I mentioned, by the way, so handicapping the race, if we go back to that, the things that I think are interesting is whether the DOD or Department of War could be the way that we get new SMRs online. that would be the other key. And one other quick thought, which is, okay, look at China. China's building more new capacity, nuclear capacity, than any other country in the world. I think the IAEA's latest numbers are something like 35 gigawatts. China's not building SMRs, Kinsey. They're building gigawatt scale light water reactors. My impression, I've not been to China, but, you know, I'll just say my impression, the Chinese are not dumb. They're doing what works, and they're not building gas cooled. They're not building sodium. They're not building thorium. They're building light water, LEU reactors that are gigawatt scale. Why? I think it's because of the things we've already discussed. They know it works. They know they have the technology. They have the workforce. They have built the supply chain, and they're going to continue building what they know they can get online and have it be reliable and affordable.
And China really is the poster child at the global scale for the sort of, you know, all of the above taken to the extreme, the build out of the grid across the board, where wind, solar, nuclear, et cetera, has been really, really staggering in China over the last several years. So to think that, you know, that is the pace and the rate at which that country is thinking, how does that kind of come to fruition in the United States is an interesting question to consider. And, you know, the answer is, not totally sure, right? I think there are a lot of different paths to get there.
I think it's simple, Kinsey. It's just that the Chinese Communist Party, Chinese central government has said, we're going to build nuclear power. And they are, because the CNPC, they have the staunch backing of the federal government. And so this isn't happenstance. And there was another good essay that came out recently, and it's called The Sovereign Signal. And I've forgotten the author used a pseudonym, but a very good article arguing this same point, which is look around the world at where nuclear is being deployed at scale. It's in countries where the federal governments are staunchly behind the nuclear sector: France, Russia, China, South Korea, Abu Dhabi. This is not some coincidence. And the argument in the paper is very straightforward. That is, if we want to see the development and deployment of new nuclear in the U.S., we have to have that same kind of backing. So going back to what I talked about earlier, which is none of this succeeds without bipartisan decadal support from Capitol Hill, from the White House and Congress, saying this is what we are going to do. Damn it. Get out of the way. We're going to make this happen. Because of that, there's a lot of friction that will stand in the way of making that happen, including a lot of special interests.
Do you think the NRC is in the position it needs to be in to facilitate that kind of expansion?
That's a good question, and one that I'm not certain I could, you know, I can kind of, my impression is that the agency is coming around and can be reformed, but I also think my friend Ray Rothrock has made a very good point about the NRC, is that there's a structural problem with the organization in that there is not one CEO of the whole thing. There's a chairman, the commissioners, and then the bureaucracy underneath that. There isn't one general manager or one executive director who can, I'll use this word, crack the whip on the staff to get them all moving in one direction. And so Rothrock's argument, and I think it's an interesting one, is that there has to be a structural change in the way the NRC is managed to make it to convert it into a more efficient kind of organization. Now, could it happen without that kind of structural change? We will see. But there's simply no doubt that for the commercial side, these companies, and many of them like Oklo, they still haven't put their permits in, their applications to get things going. So that process will be at least 4 years. So again, these companies are interesting. Their technologies are fascinating, but let's be clear about the hurdles, which takes me back. So that's NRC. Let's go to the Department of War. They don't need to deal with that, right? We have our own supply chain. We have our own vendors. We'll put it on, at Fort Hood here in Texas, or we'll put it in, on one of our Air Force bases, or we'll put it, wherever. We can do this without having to go through the NRC. And that could be, in fact, the way that the test bed for these reactors that the Pentagon and is a massive organization, the Department of War, they will be maybe I'm really getting into my metaphors here, the bell cow, or the way the test bed for some of these technologies to get them deployed.
I love the metaphors. I think this is a great way to really encapsulate a conversation that has been really holistic about some of these challenges to the deployment of nuclear at scale over the long term. As we finish up today, though, I'm curious to hear what the takeaway should be for our utility listeners. You know, a lot of what we're talking about hinges on permitting, supply chain, legislation, who's in the White House, who controls the Senate, et cetera, et cetera. For the people who are working in their everyday at a utility, what should be the takeaway in terms of the future of nuclear, the timelines that it takes to get there, some of these more sobering realities of the excitement that we have experienced over the last several months and year or so? You know, what would be your advice to those folks?
Be patient, be realistic. I think that seems obvious now, particularly when, you know, as we've reviewed these things over the last few minutes, but yeah, be patient, be realistic and be optimistic. But I think, you know, since we're talking to the utility sector itself, you know, it's interesting. We haven't seen big utility companies, the Dukes or Southerns, coming in and saying, we're going to go do this. Right. Well, why not? And I think they're looking at this and saying we have to be cautious. And I understand why. So I'll go back to what I, you know, where we started. This is going to be a decades long effort to bring U.S. nuclear back. I think it's imperative that we do so for a lot of reasons, including grid security, land sparing and technological leadership. But I think the utility sector is going to have to show leadership here. And they're going to have to be some brave CEOs who say, well, yeah, there's risk here, but we're going to go forward with this. And I think some of them are, but the utility sector is going to have to look at this with a very sober eye, and I think they will. And I'm very hopeful. I've said I'm sober, but I'm optimistic all day long. As the late Molly Ivan said, I'm optimistic to the point of idiocy, and that includes on the nuclear front.
Yeah, I love it. And I think it's interesting to consider how this all might play out in the next couple of years. To have a conversation about energy that still feels early is exciting. It will take a while to get where we're going, but we are starting the conversation now and having some very insightful, you know, thoughts and back and forths about it. So thank you, Robert. I really appreciate all of this wonderful insight. And if you are interested, we can now get into our quick lightning round. So this part of the conversation, I'm going to ask you three quick rapid fire questions. Okay. You can answer with a word, a sentence or two. We'll keep things short and sweet. Sure. And have some fun.
Okay. Ready.
First question here. What do you think is an energy industry story that maybe will surprise the most people in the next couple of years? Do you have a prediction for something that might kind of come from behind and take us all by surprise?
Reciprocating engines.
All right. I like it. Thank you for sticking to the rules of the lightning round. Next question. If you didn't end up working in this industry, what do you think might have been an alternate career path for you? What would be your plan B?
Shortstop, New York Yankees.
All right.
Hell, oh, yeah. Actually, no, wait, maybe point guard for the San Antonio Spurs.
All right. We'll take either one.
Okay.
And then finally, do you have any advice for any of our utility listeners who are tuned into this episode in terms of career, things they should be excited about? You know, what would be your parting message for those folks?
Well, now this is a lightning round, but I'll just say be optimistic. I think the nuclear, or well, the entire electric sector, I love it. I'm not here to flatter you. That's not what I do. But I love the power sector. And I speak to co-ops. I spoke to investor-owned utilities and municipally owned utilities. I love the power sector. I love what it does. What the people in the utility sector do is maintain and upgrade and continually power the what I call the mother. It's the mother network. The electric grid is the network upon which all of our critical networks depend. And so what you do is important and incredibly important. And so I think it's awesome what people in the utility sector do. I love that business. I love the whole thing.
All right. And I would second that. Thank you so much, Robert. That was a wonderful lightning round to finish out a wonderful conversation. I really, really appreciate all of the great insights that you brought to this little chat we had here today. We had a lot to cover. I think we started to get into a lot of the big stuff that I wanted to. Certainly a topic that I'm sure we will come back to time and again on the show. So we'd love to have you back sometime to talk about it when we're a decade from now and hopefully a little farther along in the story.
Well, let's not wait a decade, but happy to do it,
that
Kenzie.
Sounds good.
Happy to do it, Kenzie. It's great fun. Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you to all of our listeners for tuning in. As Robert mentioned, you can find his work at robertbryce.substack.com. We will toss a link to that Substack in the description of this episode as well. And thank you so much for tuning in. If you have any feedback or ideas that you want to share, you know where to find us. I'm Kinsey at energycentral.com, and you can head to the Energy Central platform to share your thoughts and perspectives. And I will see you next time here on Power Perspectives.